K2RIW to TechNet. Make sure you wait for the beeps.
K2RIW, KC2SHO. We can't hear the beeps out here on the other end of the IRLP link, but I'll try to guess. I know what they sound like, so play them in my head. So hopefully I'm doing that properly. Interestingly enough, first of all, thank you, and that's a pretty interesting explanation. CERN is the ring, and there are other rings around. I think Los Alamos has a smaller ring, but those are a different type of accelerator, a synchronous or a synchrotron, where Los Alamos is a linear, so that's a straight line. I think it works the same way you use the dimension, except that you don't have the benefit of being able to re-amplify an existing signal. You can only just keep sending it on down the line, or I shouldn't say amplify. You don't have the ability to accelerate continuously over and over. Well, you send it down the straight line, and eventually you have a target, or I guess there must be some kind of dummy load or place you can send that off when you don't need it. They do peel it off in several places to work in different types of labs that are set up in different ways. They do some interesting things there. I won't get into it now, but if you go to their website, you'll see all the different things they do there. Very interesting stuff to read about. Interesting thing about the anytime you're using the magnets to direct it, if you want to make a circular accelerator concern, you know, they steer that around with magnets. There's actually more X-rays and neutrinos flying out of that than there is on the linear one. That's interesting. As they try to steer it around, it fights back and shoots out the X-rays and neutrons, if I understand right. I might have said neutrinos, I meant neutrons. Let me drop it for 1 second, and then I'll give you the rest of that question you asked. So, interestingly enough, I belong to a group on Facebook called I Take Pictures of Transmitter Sites. Somebody came on and said, hey, I know there's a lot of broadcast guys on this group. Here's an interesting job. Since these high-power pulse RF transmitters that we use are very much like television transmitters, anybody with this type of experience, we apply. So there you go. I got a job through Facebook. Social media at its best. K2IW, KC2SHO. Go figure.
Question. Most recognized. We're getting a lot of benefit out of Facebook. You're getting benefit. The people use it as a social media are getting a benefit. I bought some stock in Facebook, and my goodness, is my stock expanding very nicely, so I'm getting a financial benefit also. The linear accelerator at Stanford University, SLAC, Standard Linear Accelerator, might be similar to what you're describing. It only accelerates the particles once, but I think there are multiple stages of acceleration along the length. The good news about a circular accelerator is you can keep doing the process over and over again to eventually bring the particles up to whatever amount of momentum that you desire, getting them closer and closer to the speed of light. That's the good news. The bad news is that they develop more and more apparent mass, more and more centrifugal force, more and more magnetic focusing is required. Eventually, you run out of magnetic focus, and because you are moving them in a circle, which means they're continuously being accelerated toward the center of the circle, they're going to continuously be trying to radiate energy, subparticles, and so on. So there's pluses and minuses there. Let's see what Wes has got to say on this. N2XJN, K2RIW, go ahead, Wes.
Yeah, I have two parts of the question. One is, when we start to accelerate the electrons, then the other particles could only arise to connection with those electrons if you have a smash on them. It means if you have you directed the beam of electrons and you actually hit that beam of electron into something. That's what I was, and then you can talk about electrons, the neutrons and other particles, so that I will need additional information from you guys. And the second one is, I see on KC2SH or the Kazakhstan transmitter installation in Pumpkin Run, I wonder what Kazakhstan transmitter came from. That's for KC2SH.
I believe most particle accelerators do something in the very beginning. If they want to accelerate electrons, they do something to make sure they start off with only electrons. If they want to accelerate protons, they do something to begin to make sure they've only got protons. In some cases, I guess they do accelerate partially ionized nucleus. There, I'm not sure. But most of the time, the particles are of only one type that are being accelerated, is my knowledge. But once those particles hit a target, and depending on what the target is made out of, all kinds of things can be coming out of there as a result. But as far as Wes's question is concerned, on your, I think it's about your QIZ.com pictures, John, go right ahead with that answer. KC2SHO, K2RIW in the TechNet.
And if you don't, sorry, I may have forgotten about the beeps. If you don't mind, I'll comment on the other injections, if you will. So I know, you know, they inject RF as the as a source, and at LANSS or the Los Alamos Nuclear Nuclear something center, they inject positive and negative hydrogen, two different beams, and they also pulse in a very large DC. Not really sure how it all comes together into the beam, but it is, I do know that they do negative and positive hydrogen ions. And let me make sure I have it before I go on. And in response to Wes's question, I work for a company called EMT. It has a history of making transmitters out of Italy. And for one of our projects, we delivered some DTV transmitters to Kazakhstan for digital television testing for their digital transition to go from analog to digital. So we delivered the test transmitters out there for them to work on and see how they were, to test for their transition. So that was a fun project, and got to see a new part of the world. Very interesting place, and one of the places where I was first really able to see the stars so clearly that it was almost life-changing. Up there on the steppe of Kazakhstan, maybe about 3 o'clock in the morning, staring up into the sky with zero light pollution. Really incredible. K2RIW, KC2SHO.
Yeah, there's a similar place in the United States. I think it's called Cherry Valley, Pennsylvania, which is extremely dark for many miles around, no stray light. And the astronomers on Long Island, amateur astronomers who go there periodically during the year, say it's even better than Stellafane, Vermont. And that when you really, with a fully dark set of healthy eyes, see what's really up there in the universe, it's for many people life-changing. Makes them suddenly get deeper into astronomy. So I'm glad you had that experience. And I'm wondering how soon you're going to be out to Los Alamos. By way of Echolink and IRLP, you'll be able to talk to us periodically and describe what it's like out there. It sounds like it's going to be a fun experience as I see it, John. KC2SHO, how soon? And you got to report back to us. How soon will you be there? K2RIW, you got it, sir. John.
One more question.
Yeah, I heard Wes in there with one more question, so hopefully I have it here, and then I guess you'll pass it back to him. Yeah, really neat experience, and I got to travel the world a lot with my broadcasting background, and fortunately that's brought me to this subject here tonight, which is going to be exciting and new. I need to be there, let's say, the first day of February, for argument's sake. To start, and I knew this back in November, so I gave them 3 months notice that I would, from the time I accepted until I would arrive on site. And let me tell you, you can collect a lot of junk in 12 years, and be struggling to get out of here before then, so I may have to go out ahead of the family. We'll see what happens. One way or another, I'm going to be there to start this job. There's no way I'm going to let that falter. That pretty shack you've seen there is no longer in existence. The space is here, and there's a couple of radios, but it's mostly disassembled, and we're getting things boxed up, so we're making the move. It's going to happen, and got to start making a real push here. All hinges on the sale of the house, of course, so those kind of things can make a big difference in life, you know. K2RIW, I hope I answered all the questions. KC2SHO.
Yes, you did answer all the questions, John, and I thank you. We're very envious. You looks like you're going to have a fun job. And when it comes to collecting things, we amateurs are pack rats. As you know, the Mount Airy VHS Society, that particular group of very enthusiastic amateurs in the Philadelphia area, they call themselves the pack rats. A philosopher I know, a ham radio operator, is now a silent key, used to tell me, the process of living is the process of collecting things. Eventually, they come and collect you. That was his left-hand philosophy. Wes, you had a further question for John, maybe? N2XJN, K2RIW.
Yeah, I was kind of puzzled with the hydrogen ion referred by him, and I know that it's not a big deal to lose the electron, and then you are left only with a positive particle in the atom. How is the reverse? It's kind of puzzle for me. So is it always that prior to you going to hydronium ion or Zundel cation, in the end of the process, first you always have to lose the electron intuition?
One of the things I recommend for you, John, it's not very expensive. Buy a particular book. It's called The Quantum Frontier, subtitled The Large Hadron Collider, by Don Lincoln. Let's see, who's the publisher of this thing? Johns Hopkins. Anyhow, not a very expensive book, but it'll give you a lot of information about state-of-the-art particle accelerators. And so once you know what the really big one in CERN, Switzerland is doing, you'll be able to compare it to the one you're going to go see, The Quantum Frontier, The Large Hadron Collider, by Don Lincoln. I do recommend you buy that book and read it, and you'll enjoy it. I've got it sitting right here alongside of me, and I tried to read it a couple of times. Reasonably well done. Not easy reading, if you're trying to memorize all of the individual details, if you know what I mean. Okay, I'm going to move on to Joe right now. Joe, go easy with us. Last week or 2 weeks ago, you gave us a question that kept us going for a solid hour. The B2RYY, K2RIW in the TechNet. I'm also going to give one more call to KD2IXP, who signed in, and we didn't get a chance to get back to him right away. Kilo Delta 2, India, X-ray Papa. Are you there, John? K2RIW. And one more call for Joe. WA2RYY. Romeo Yankee Yankee. K2RIW. Go ahead, Joe.
I think you were transmitting on top of me. That's why you couldn't hear me.
Sorry about that. You got the floor.
Can I get back to you about 2 minutes? Do you have something else to talk about for about 2 minutes or so?
Okay. We'll go over to John to begin the mailbag, and then we'll come back to you. KC2WGB, K2RIW. What have you seen on the Echo Link tonight, John? And did you get a good number of requests this week? KC2WGB with the mailbag. K2RIW in the TechNet. Okay, maybe John got called away. Maybe with a phone call or whatever. Let's see if Joe has come back yet. The B2RYY, if you've recalled, returned, K2RIW. anybody. Am I alone?
T2, enjoy.
Go right ahead, Eric.
What do you know about a Doherty amplifier? It's an interesting device. You want to talk about it?
I only know a little bit about it. It is a kind of a device which has what looks like two parallel output stages, but they're not directly in parallel. And the way the thing works is that the first stage is a kind of linear amplifier, and the second stage is biased into cutoff, so that as the drive signal becomes stronger and stronger, and the first amplifier stage is beginning to saturate, the other stage that's also getting its signal, but it's heavily biased off, starts conducting, and it starts adding power, and with fancy impedance matching and quadrature-like circuits, the second amplifier comes on to cover the high end of the amplitude scale, and therefore the overall amplifier, the Doherty, ends up with considerably higher efficiency, even though linear amplification is taking place. Under normal circumstances, a linear amplifier gives you 50% efficiency at best, only at maximum power output. Well, that maximum power output 50% region can be extended through a lot more dynamic range with the Doherty technique. But if you want extremely high linearity, let me drop. If you want extremely high linearity and you're trying to take a complicated signal that would ordinarily create intermodulation, distortion, sidebands, because your complicated signal has multiple frequency components to it, and you pour that through a Doherty amplifier, it has a couple of minor kinds of non-linearity built into its operation, and therefore some relatively sophisticated pre-distortion is required if you want to use a Doherty with the combination of higher efficiency and high linearity. But it's got a lot of capability, and it keeps coming up again and again with modern amplifying devices. That's what little I know about it. I know if you Google those words, you'll find a whole lot of articles, which you've probably already done there, Eric. And have any of your broadcast transmitters used a Doherty-type technique? KE2EJ, our broadcast engineer. K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2RIW, KE2EJ. Yeah, I'm looking at actually the newer digital transmitters are coming out with Doherty-type amplifier circuits. From what I know, it was invented a very long time ago by the name of William H. Doherty with Bell Labs, and it was done in 1938. And in the tube days, well, it was a Class B type amplifier, as opposed to many of the transmitters we have today, which are actually Class A amplifiers. So I'm just looking for your input. Yeah, I've done the research on Wikipedia and a few other places, and I just see it as a very interesting device, especially for digital transmitters, because we're basically dealing with peak RF power throughout the whole thing. So just wanted to get your input. K2RIW, K2J.
And as you look further into that, Eric, and you find out more about it, please come back and tell us what you find. Your stories are always interesting to listen to. Let's see if Joe is back. W-A-2-R-Y-Y. K-2-R-I-W. Go right ahead, Joe.
And I did wait for all the beats. Yes, I'm back. Okay. Here's a question for this week. Let me give you some follow-up for it first, or some lead into it. I was doing some tests with my antenna tuner that I purchased many, many months ago and did some modifications to make it work better on 160. I took a bird watt meter and I wanted to measure the actual throughput loss of the thing, which is fairly simple to do. I set up my transceiver to give me 100 watts of power into the bird 43 using a 2 to 30 meg slug, 100 watt full scale, into a 50 ohm load. So that was easy enough to do. It pretty much almost matched my calibration of the output of the HF transceiver when it set the full power at 100 watts on both, transceiver, the wattmeter. I put the antenna tuner in line before the wattmeter and tuned it to the minimum SWR as far as the radio transceiver saw, and I saw about 85 watts. So that calculates out to about 0.6, 0.7 dB of loss across the tuner. So then I took the wattmeter and hooked it up to the antenna, but left it after the antenna tuned it. Now, this is where my question is going to come up with. Reset. What I tried on the first band of 160 meters, I put the slug in the center position so I wouldn't pin the meter, because I sort of knew what I thought was going to happen. And I just simply tuned the matchbox to the antenna tuner to give me no return loss as far as the transceiver, as far as the transceiver was concerned at a mid frequency in the 160 meter band. I put the watt meter in the forward position that had pinned the meter, so I had to turn my power down to get the meter to not pin at full scale. So I figured, well, let me try it with a lower power initially set into the from the transceiver. I set the transceiver down to 25 watts of power, and these are my readings after the antenna tuner with the transceiver set for 25 watts of power, not 100 watts of power. At 160 meters, I showed a forward power. This is with the burn-through line after the antenna tuner looking into the antenna line, which is a long wire. At 160, I showed 40 watts forward and 30 watts reflected. On 80 meters, I showed 52 watts forward, 30 watts reflected. 40 meters went up quite significantly. It showed 92 forward, 66 reflected. And the highest my tuner let me tune was into the 30-meter range. It gave me 45 forward and 25 reflected. But my question is, why am I seeing these crazy readings after the antenna tuner, knowing that I'm putting only 25 watts in, but the burn watt meter showing a significantly higher reading coming out of the other end, or what I'm putting into the apparent mismatched antenna? Back to you.
And you're now seeing one of those very tricky characteristics of impedance mismatch. It's quite possible that your transceiver is continuing to put out exactly 25 watts. And if the antenna tuner had no loss at all, to keep it simple, no insertion loss, it runs ice cold, just a purely reactive device, and you're going into an antenna that's far from 50 ohms of input impedance. If, for instance, I just choose a number out of the air, assume the antenna really is a 200 ohm impedance to your 50 ohm transmission line. That's a, if I did it correctly, it's a 4-to-1 standing wave ratio. A 4-to-1 standing wave ratio is a significant amount of power being reflected. A little bit shy of 50% of the power is being reflected in a 4-to-1 standing wave ratio. At 4-to-1 standing wave ratio from the antenna back toward the antenna tuner, the antenna tuner, if it's lossless and properly set, it takes every bit of that power that got reflected, re-reflects it forward. Not only does it re-reflect it forward, it re-reflects it forward in phase with the power coming out of the transmitter that got to the antenna tuner at this time. So you're adding, you think you're adding powers, you're really adding voltages. Let me drop. Because the antenna, in your particular case, assume it really was a 5-to-1 standing wave ratio. I think 5-to-1 standing wave ratio is very close to the point where 50% of the power is reflected. And yet, your antenna is made out of low-loss materials, your feed line will assume is low-loss, and your antenna tuner is made out of low-loss material, and the transmitter is continuously cranking out 25 watts. Okay. How in the world can the antenna radiate 25 watts when 50% of whatever you give it is going to be reflected? The answer was, you'd have to give the antenna 50 watts. So, in my crazy example, if the forward power going to the antenna was 50 watts, and the reflected power was 25, you're not violating any of the laws of physics when you are radiating 25 of those watts that the transmitter is generating. Assuming the antenna tuner runs ice cold, your feed line runs ice cold, and your antenna itself is made out of low loss material, and it's running ice cold, and 25 watts of real energy is flowing. 25 joules per second is coming out of the transmitter, and it's going somewhere, being radiated into space. So your forward power, measured on a bird watt meter after the antenna tuner, in my example, will read 50 watts. And you're not violating the laws of physics. What is the antenna tuner doing? Antenna tuner, in my example, is representing the fact that the antenna that you're refeeding, let me drop. In my example, it recognizes the fact that your antenna is 5 times 50, is 250 ohms of resistive impedance, in my example, and is doing a voltage step up. The antenna also could be a 5 to 1 standing wave ratio where it's 10 ohms instead of 50, and now it would be stepping up the current. You would be setting the antenna tuner differently. Your bird watt meter, after an antenna tuner, is measuring true forward power. And under cases of anything better than a 1-to-1 standing wave ratio, the forward power will be greater than the power being generated. Now you got to, we've now got this difficult problem of explaining what you call that forward power. A significant number of people will say, you're reading 50 watts, you're really radiating 25, the other 25 is really reactive power bouncing back and forth. That's one possible explanation. And it has some merit. So your bird watt meter is telling you the truth. In other words, by way of that directional coupler that's inside the bird watt meter, that directional coupler is, in my example, seeing 50 watts going forward. Let me drop. And a certain group of amateurs will say, hey, that's only reactive power. It's only 25 real. Well, I say no. I say that 50 watts apparent forward is real. I can take that apparent forward power coming out of that directional coupler. Let's assume now it's a 10 dB directional coupler. It only gives you a sample of 10% of what's going on. 10% of 50 watts would be 5 watts. In that example, if it was a 10 to 1 directional coupler, a 10 dB directional coupler, I could take that 5 watts output and I could light a light bulb with it. That's real. I'd get 5 watts of light, if you know what I mean. So you are getting higher power forward than you're being generated. But that power is really bouncing back and forth. Your transmission line between your antenna tuner and your antenna is a kind of cavity resonator. A resonator really is, in almost all cases, a LC network or a transmission line network that has a nearly short circuit or an open circuit on the two ends, so the signal is bouncing back and forth. But because it bounces back and forth and only at one particular frequency, or all those bounces in step with each other, co-phase with each other, we call that resonance. So the power bouncing back and forth in the resonance, in my example, is 50 watts, but the transmitter is only continuously generating 25, and the ideal world, you will be radiating into space 25. It takes 50 watts going to the antenna, in my example, to radiate 25, and the other 25 watts is being reflected back, and it comes around again for another pass. I know that this is not easy to accept the first few times you hear it, Joe. WA2LYY, this wall is crazy. K2LIW in the TechNet.
6DPZ with a comment.
Yeah, Joe first, and then we'll come back to the comment. Go ahead, Joe.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Yeah, I was listening to Joe on the input when he timed out. He saw 92 watts forward and 60 watts reflected when he went to, I think he said, 40 meters. Once again, in theory, if all the numbers were coming out right, if you're generating 25 watts, you're radiating 25 watts, and it's the difference between those two powers. If you had more than a 5-to-1 standing wave ratio, like a 10-to-1 standing wave ratio, the forward power and the reflected power become bigger numbers. If I had a 100-to-1 standing wave ratio antenna and a thoroughly lossless antenna tuner and a thoroughly lossless transmission line, my real transmitter could be generating 25 watts. The transmitter sees a perfect 50 ohms going into the antenna tuner. Coming out of the antenna tuner, where the antenna is a 100-to-1 standing wave ratio, I might see a kilowatt forward and 975 watts reflected. And I'm not violating physics when I do that. As the standing wave ratio gets higher and higher, the percentage of power radiated gets smaller and smaller. But if you've got low loss materials and you're not dissipating that power, then the power you must be applying to the antenna has to become a bigger and bigger number. And a bigger and bigger percentage is bouncing back and forth in your so-called cavity resonator that really is an antenna tuner plus transmission line plus antenna. It's a cavity resonator, highly resonant system, and within a resonant system you can get, with high enough Q, the Q is the voltage rise at resonance, the current rise at resonance, with high enough Q you can get some really big numbers. Hal's going to give us a simple explanation of all this. K6DPZ, K2RIW, go ahead, Al.
K2RIW, the Chestnut, K6DPZ. I don't know if I heard this correctly. He is putting a directional coupling wattmeter after his tuner and then going to his antenna. Is that correct or wrong, Dick? Let me ask you that question first, okay?
That's absolutely correct. He's doing the right thing to do that. There are a large number of people who believe you cannot put a bird wattmeter into a system that is not registering 50 ohms at that point. In which case, are you telling me a bird wattmeter can never be used in anything except an ideal system? And if the system is ideal, why using the bird wattmeter in the first place? A bird wattmeter, if you read the instruction manual, you can put it into any impedance you want, and you're going to get some crazy sounding numbers for forward power and reverse power. Now you've got to be careful how you interpret those numbers. There are a lot of people who are about to say what you're about to say. You can't put a bird wattmeter after an antenna tuner. It's a perfectly logical thing to do if you're smart enough to know how to interpret the results. K6DPZ, K2RIW, that's a strongly felt opinion, Hal. Go ahead.
K2RIW, K6DPZ. Okay. Let's get down the basics. Normally, the bird wattmeter has a line section, which is designed to be a 50-ohm line section. If you put the bird wattmeter on the output of the tuner, your impedance coming out of that tuner can be a very wide impedance range. So as far as I'm concerned, you'll be getting nothing by doing it. If you want to match the impedance of the tuner to the antenna, you put the wattmeter on the input of the tuner. That's where you're concerned to have your maximum transfer for a match. The output on the feed line, yes, you'll get a relative reading because using a directional coupler, but the readings you'll get will be inappropriate, as far as I'm concerned, Dick. Over.
May I make a comment?
Okay, I strongly disagree in this particular situation, Hal, and you and I are in an area now where we're going to disagree, and people listening can decide what they're going to believe. It's their choice. Joe is a guy with enough resources. He's got a pair of Bird Model 43 wattmeters. He puts one of them in front of the antenna tuner. He puts one of them after the antenna tuner. He looks at the first one and juggles the knobs on the antenna tuner until the first one says he's got 25 watts forward and 0 watts coming back. Now he's got the proper setting of the antenna tuner. The other Bird wattmeter on the output of the antenna tuner is in some cases telling him 60 watts forward and 20 watts coming back. And you've got to be careful how you interpret that. You're telling him that all readings on a bird wattmeter after an antenna tuner are useless. I strongly disagree. It is giving him good, scientific, useful information if you know how to interpret it. If your antenna is going to be reflecting, in one of his examples, half of all the power you put into it, but you still want to radiate 25 watts, then you've got to be putting 50 watts into it. And it's perfectly legal with a 25-watt transmitter, if you know what I mean. Power is bouncing back and forth. Those readings on the bird wattmeter on the output of his antenna tuner are real. They are useful if you're smart enough to know how to interpret them. They're telling you a real truth. You've decided to throw those away. That is your choice. Joe is a little bit more of a scientist. He knows those numbers are telling him something real and interpretable. And the manual on the bird wattmeter tells you you can do that, and you got to be careful how you interpret it. Now, Joe, I think you're doing something real when you put the bird wattmeter on the output side of the antenna tuner. You're not wasting your time to do that. It's telling you useful information if you're smart enough to interpret it. To be 2RYY, K2RIW, go ahead, Joe.
Start repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Okay, I turned it over to Joe. Go ahead, Joe.
Okay, maybe I should have elaborated this about what I'm using. I'm only using 1 meter, but the transceiver is a Kenwood TS690. And what it has on the front panel during transmit is two indications simultaneously on the digital meter. You can look at your forward power and your reflected power at the same time. It has two different graphs and within the same meter assembly housing, or what do you want to call it, meter display. So I can look at my forward power and reflected power as the transceiver sees it looking out from the transceiver. And when I purposely detune the antenna tuner to a 3-to-1 or more, or worse, VSWR, I can watch my forward power starting to pull back. So I am seeing something that I believe is fairly correct.
Yes, stand by a second. Because of what's built into your transceiver, you have the equivalent of a pair of Bird watt meters. You have the equivalent of a Bird watt meter on the input of the antenna tuner. It is the directional coupler power indicator that's in your transceiver, and you have a real Bird 43 on the output. That's a perfectly logical thing to do. You've got to be careful how you interpret the results, but it is telling you a kind of truth if you know what you're looking at. You're allowed to give a rebuttal on that one, Hal. K6DPZ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2RIW in the TechNet, K6DPZ. The only rebuttal I have is, if you want to know what the impedance is coming out of your tuner, going into your antenna, if you want to know the true power that's going out from the tuner, you put a current meter into an RMS voltmeter, you figure out your power. And you can also figure out basically the impedance. That's my last comment. I don't know why you're running a test the way you are, but I work with open lines, I work with line sections, and if you have a good RMS voltmeter, if you have a thermocouple current meter, you'll find out a lot of information. T6DPZ.
Hal's method doesn't take phase angle into consideration.
It certainly does not. Now, rather than putting a current meter in a voltmeter and trying to figure out the phase and all of that jazz about what's going on the output of the antenna tuner, the Bird watt meter is telling you exactly what you want to know. And the data coming out of the Bird watt meter on the output end of the antenna tuner, that data is traceable to the Bureau of Standards. It is real data. You have to be a little careful how you interpret it. But it is telling you an extremely exact truth. The fact that a whole lot of people believe that a Bird watt meter will always lie to you if it's not a 50-ohm complete perfect system, and no system is always 50 ohms perfect, does that mean you can never use a Bird watt meter? Of course not. You read the manual of the antenna of the Bird watt meter. You can, if you're smart enough, you can take a 50-ohm Bird watt meter and put it in the middle of a 70-ohm transmission line. If you're smart enough to know what you're looking at, it is telling you a truth. I wonder if you agree with that one, Eric. KE2EJ, K2RIW on the TechNet.
K2RIW, KE2EJ. Yeah, I remember a lot of years ago. You can do a mathematical proof by doing vector arithmetic. And you'll find that the Bird watt meter is pretty damn accurate. We forget that the way the Bird watt meter is actually picking up this information is by looking at the center conductor line that you happen to be using and the energy that it is rectifying. So, you know, you can get a lot of useful information out of it by working on that side. And we forget that the antenna, as you say, is a measurement cavity, but you just think of the output of it as a pi network and that inductor. There's a lot of stored energy happening. So, K2RIW, K2J.
Yeah, every resonator system has a parameter you can measure, which is called Q. Q really means how much resonance, so to speak. Q has got five or six definitions. Voltage rise at resonance. Current rise at resonance. Rise time. Fall time. Center frequency divided by bandwidth. And energy dissipated per cycle versus energy stored per cycle. There's five or six definitions of Q. Five or six different ways of measuring the characteristic. But it's all the exact same phenomenon. in that dipole of yours, your dipole usually has a Q of around 10. The energy you put into that dipole is going to bounce back and forth in the dipole roughly 10 times before it finally gets radiated. You adjust the dipole for a particular length. That particular length, we call it resonance. Resonant means that all of those bounces stay in step with each other. They're co-phase. They're congruent. They lie on top of each other on an oscilloscope display. You carefully adjust the length, the electrical length of the dipole. Let me drop it. To do that, you recognize the fact that it is a standing wave structure, by definition, by Krauss. A dipole is a standing wave structure kind of antenna. Energy is going to bounce back and forth before it finally gets radiated. Therefore, if your dipole has a Q of 10, and you're putting 100 volts of RF energy into the dipole, the tips of the dipole will probably show 100, you're putting 100 volts in, you're going to get 1,000 volts from tip to tip. Voltage rise at resonant 10 to 1, Q of 10. You're putting 1 ampere into the dipole, we'll say. Somewhere in the dipole, you're going to find 10 amperes is flowing, even though you're only applying 1 ampere. That's what a Q of 10 resonant circuit will do. Your antenna tuner, plus transmission line, plus antenna that's less than perfect, is a high Q resonating structure. Energy is bouncing back and forth. By the way you've tuned the antenna tuner, you've forced all those bounces to be in phase with each other. That's how you made the VISWR on the input end go down to 1 to 1. So Q and all of its ramifications, standing wave structures and all of their ramifications, standing wave ratio. These situations, we amateurs are going to be discussing it and hashing it for years to come. It is not simple. Portions of it are not common sense. There's a whole lot of mishmash, misunderstanding on this. A good percentage of the guys, let me drop it. A good percentage of the guys you can talk to on 20 meters on a Saturday afternoon will tell you, I don't use an antenna tuner. It's a wasteful device. My antenna, I'm putting 100 watts into the antenna, and from out of the transmitter I'm getting 100 watts, and 50 watts is coming back to the antenna tuner. What does the antenna tuner do with that 50 watts? It throws it away. They believe that. The antenna tuner is thoroughly shielded. It's not radiating the power. If it's made out of a quality component, it runs ice cold. It's not dissipating the power. What's left of the 50 watts coming from the antenna with high VISWR coming back to the antenna tuner, the antenna tuner is re-reflecting that power forward in phase with the power coming out of the transmitter right now. And those voltages are adding. Therefore, you're going to get higher voltages, higher currents. A real highly calibrated directional coupler called Bird wattmeter will show you, in that example, you might see 500 watts forward and 400 watts coming back, even though your transmitter is only creating 100 watts. And as crazy as those numbers sound, it is telling you a truth if you know how to interpret it. As long as you know what you're looking at, it is perfectly legal to put a Bird wattmeter in any piece of coaxial cable you've got. You got to be careful how you interpret the results. It is telling you a truth. I don't believe everybody's going to accept this the first time they hear it. I don't blame them. It's not easy to swallow all this jazz. I wonder if any of this makes a little more sense, Joe. W-H-U-R-Y-Y, K-2-R-I-W in the TechNet.
Hey, sir, here.
I'm glad you did. We're going to take Joe first and then Eric in that order. Go ahead, Joe.
We've just got much more of a severe mismatch. Here's, I guess, the last part of the question connected with this. Can they determine my VSWR or apparent VSWR by looking at the Bird wattmeter, looking at my forward and reflective power, even though it's higher?
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Okay, while the machine timed out, Joe was asking the very logical question. Can I take those power readings from the Bird wattmeter on the output end of the antenna tuner, the forward power and reverse power, and interpret that into VISWR? The answer is absolutely yes. That's in the manual of the Bird 43 wattmeter. You go to the right page of the Bird 43 wattmeter instruction manual. It tells you to take the forward power and reverse power, take the quotient of the two, divide one into the other, take the square root of that number, you call that gamma, and then you take 1 plus gamma divided by 1 minus gamma, and that is standing wave ratio. So you take the ratio, take the square root of the ratio, and go into that formula, 1 plus rho over 1 minus rho. Rho is what it should be called. So can you take the forward and reverse power readings of a bird watt meter and interpret it into standing wave ratio? Absolutely. I know that Hal thinks that all those readings are useless. The manual of the bird watt meter tells you to take those readings, applying to that mathematics, and it tells you the standing wave ratio in that of that antenna at that time. That, to me, is very useful information. Let me turn it over to Eric, who's been waiting, and then he's going to turn it over to Joe. KE2EJ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2RIW, K2EJ. I just wanted to mention that, you know, in broadcasting, we're only dealing with a single frequency. And we look at antenna SWR ratios, the SWR ratios of 1 to 1.0762, or numbers like that. And on a piece of hard line, which might be a piece of 3-inch or 8-inch coax, we put these directional couplers on them as power tap-offs. And as a general rule, what will be done with a section of line based on the given frequency that you're operating, when they calibrate it, they'll use a vector network analyzer, and they will also take the phase angle of the position at which the pickup is precisely and use that as a correction factor. And because it's a single frequency, it's kind of easy to do. It's simple vector arithmetic, and you get a precise numbers in which to work with your transmitter. K2RIW, because most people forget that we're talking about essentially sine waves here that are being manipulated in terms of the reflections that are occurring and how they add and subtract from one another. K2RIW, K2J.
K2AXP.
Very fine, Eric, and thank you. And John, KD2IHP, we called you earlier, and I know you're on our list, and you're allowed to make comments right now. And after you make your comments, and after we finish with Joe, we're going to go right back to you with your original question. KD2IXP, K2RIW, you got it, John.
Good guys. Thank you, Dick. I just had a question regarding LMR 400. As you know, it's pretty difficult to work with, because the solid core makes it difficult to bend. But they have a product called Ultraflex, which is an ABR product based on the LMR 400, and it's got a braided core. Is there any difference in the performance between the braided core LMR Ultraflex and the solid core?
I don't think there's a great deal of difference. If it's LMR 400, which is really the outside diameter of 0.4 inches, I think is what it stands for. So the braided core versus the solid core, I think the performance is very similar. However, it's a very high-quality manufacturer, and he will tell you dB of loss per 100 feet, and that's all you care about, per se. If one of them has got 1.5 dB per 100 feet and the other one's got 1.6 dB per 100 feet, they're so darn close, they're almost the same. So by way of the manufacturer's specifications, you'll know that real soon. In the case of flexible cable, a very desirable place to put that would be around your rotator. The kind of LMR that's got a solid core, if you use that as the piece of cable that goes around your rotator and it's being twisted back and forth, that solid core is going to be taking your center conductor and twisting it back and forth in your type N connector, so to speak, and it's going to be creating metal chips. So around a rotator, there's a lot of advantage of using a flexible type cable. Oh, was that you, Eric, or whoever it was? Go right ahead. K2RIW.
Yeah, time
for
wire cable and a few others make the version of LMR 400 with solid core, which is intended to be fixed and strapped to a tower or not moved, and they make a stranded core, which is intended to be used as a flexible form. And actually, you'll find the one with the stranded core doesn't have a foil shield. It has a braided shield so that it can take the flex. And and that's why they make both kinds.
Do you have reason to believe that the performance of the two is fairly similar, Eric? Wait for the beeps.
As far as loss is concerned, if you look at the specification, the difference is in jacketing, weatherproofing, and the ability to be flat. There are applications where you need to have the cable move around. If you look at the specifications for the solid core stuff, it has a minimum curve radius that you should not exceed. When you exceed it, you actually damage the cable.
Darn good information, and I thank you, Eric. So, John, I think they'll let you sleep a little easier now that you know these qualities of LMR 400 and its equivalent. KD2IXB, K2RIW, you got it, John.
Your receivers. Thank you, Dick. Thank you, Eric. I appreciate your time and your answers. Have a good evening, both of you.
Terry, Terry, drop.
Now, I know we didn't completely finish with you, Joe, the P2RYY. Many people have not seen that chapter or that page of the owner's manual for the Bird 43. But by way of that ratio of forward power and reverse power, and the square root of it, which is rho, and use 1 plus rho over 1 minus rho, that Bird wattmeter is giving you a beautiful answer, traceable to the Bureau of Standards, as to what is the standing wave ratio of your antenna. That's the information it's giving you when you put the Bird wattmeter after the antenna tuner. A perfectly logical thing to do. The owner's manual tells you to do that. WA2RYY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
I'll still get an antenna now.
No, because I bought these meters years and years ago, and they didn't come in the owner's manual. I got the cases, you know, a couple of meters. A good collection of slugs and so forth, but no owner's manuals. I have to probably go online to see if I can find that information, but I do thank you, Dick, for, bringing that up, so I'll have to approach it that way. But I just brought up as a general, generally as a topic to, to discuss something like this, because I'm sure other people are probably wondering about the same thing I'm wondering about, too. Like, it makes you think that the meter's indicating something wrong. It's probably indicating something that you just have to interpret to know what it's really telling you.
Joe, if you want a copy of the manual, send me an SASC, I'll send it out to you for nothing.
The manual is easily downloaded. I have done that. The Bird wattmeter has had almost no change of its design for a zillion years. Online is the Bird wattmeter manual, owner's manual, no problem. KE2EJ, K2RIW, go ahead, Eric. Wait for the beeps.
No, you just answered the first part. I was going to say that on the Bird website, you can get the manual and a number of different charts that will allow you to look at different voltages and allow you to come up with SWR. Let's not forget that when we're talking about SWR, we're talking about a ratio. Whether you do it at 1 watt or 1,000 watts, it's still a ratio. And whether the meter is accurately calibrated or not, you're still going to get a ratio. Because as a flood is pointed one way, it's going to generate a particular voltage that's sent to the meter. And because it's a very simple directional coupler, when you turn the flood the other way, it's going to give you that voltage. Whether it's calibrated or not, the ratio is still going to be a ratio. K2RIW, K3J.
Eric, K6DPC.
Eric, with what you just said, it is true 98% of the time. However, there's a catch. The Bird wattmeter slug, reading forward power and reverse power, does a beautiful job of doing it if the slug is not damaged. Built into the slug is a directional coupler. Built into the slug is a dummy load resistor that's always required for a directional coupler in order to have high directivity. If you and I were foolish enough to take the 5-watt slug, and my 1,500-watt transmitter is going into a very low standing wave ratio antenna. I've got 1,500 watts going forward, and I've got 2 watts coming back. And if I use the 1,500-watt slug, I can't actually read the 2 watts coming back. So you might be tempted to take the 5-watt slug to use to read reverse power. Don't do that. You do that, all that excess power is going into that dummy load resistor. You burned it up, and your bird watt meter slug no longer has directivity. It'll still read power, but it no longer has directivity.
Repeater, timeout.
If your slug loses directivity, that's the one case when the forward power and reverse power no longer tell you a truth. If it loses directivity in the forward power, it's reading some of the reverse power. And in the reverse mode, it's reading some of the forward power. Therefore, those two numbers become contaminated. So you and I, in theory, can damage a slug so that it loses directivity. And you can find that out real fast by taking a known good dummy load and putting a known amount of power from the bird watt meter into that slug. And if you're putting 100 watts into the slug, and into your known good dummy load, you read 100 watts forward and 1 watt coming back, you know your dummy load is good, and you know your slug has got high directivity. If in that particular case you read 100 watts forward and 30 watts coming back into a known good dummy load, then you know your slug has lost its directivity. That internal resistor could have been damaged. It's a rare case, but it can happen. I wonder if you've ever heard of that one, Eric. And there are guys who are running moon-bounce rigs with 1,500 watts, and they really want to carefully adjust the antenna. They want the reflective power to be down to 1 watt, and therefore they try to use the 5-watt slug in the reverse mode to read the 1 watt when 1,500 watts is going forward. And they don't realize when they're doing that, they're burning up their slug. KE2EJ, K2RIW in the TechNet, that has happened.
Easier to comment. That resistor changes value in the slug did. The impedance of the slug is different. But if you find out the impedance of the slug, you can still get away with it. Measuring at that impedance level.
Negative, negative, negative. Eric first. KE2EJ, go ahead, Eric.
Dick, I can see it.
Now, let me tell you a funny little story. We have another guy that sits by the transmitter, and this is a 24 kilowatt transmitter. It's got a 30 kilowatt slug, and he wanted to look at the reverse power coming back because he wasn't sure that things were right. He decided to put a 10 watt slug in there because the transmitter said it was only getting back 4 watts. Well, after that, he was wondering, there was a little bit of puff of smoke that came out of the slug. So, yeah, I've seen that happen. And actually, because of the way the resistor is mounted in there, it kind of a little dripped onto the white plastic, and you see the little hole that it made in it. But, yeah, I've seen and known people to do that, and they don't understand why.
Depending on how you've designed your particular directional coupler, and you've got a super miniature directional coupler built inside of the slug of a bird watt meter. In order for it to have high directivity, there's a very carefully chosen resistor inside the slug that in general is not a 50 ohm resistor. It's some very carefully chosen resistor, so that within the design of that directional coupler, that resistor as a load for the coupler gives high directivity. You burn up that resistor so it has some other value. That slug is now useless. There is no magic impedance of line where you can now use that slug and get reliable, high directivity, accurate readings. You have damaged that slug and it's got to be repaired. So if you change the value of that resistor by your abuse of that slug needs repair. You cannot use it with any reasonable accuracy. Some of that's what you're saying now, and I strongly disagree with that one. K6DPZ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Depends if you heat the resistor up enough to make it smoke or just to heat up to change the little value. If you change the little value, you can still get away with it. If you made it smoke, then you got some problems.
Okay, let's go back to the beginning. Do not abuse a slug. It's good sounding common sense to try to read 5 watts coming back with a 10 watt slug on a 1500 watt transmitter. It's good common sense. Do not do that. If you're running 1500 watts on a transmitter, maybe you can push your luck and go to a 150 watt slug. You're pushing your luck. Really should be using a 1500 watt slug no matter what direction you're measuring.